A conservative Republican president has taken office promising to reshape the military. Soldiers expected a big change from President Clinton, but they're disappointed. Frustrated by budget cuts, furious that gays can serve, and isolated from civilians, the U.S. Army seethes on the edge of mutiny. This, at least, is the scenario described by Thomas E. Ricks in an eerie novel called A Soldier's Duty. It's set in the near future. A lot of the action takes place in the hallways of the Pentagon, where soldiers plot and scheme as they walk past the paintings of dead generals on the walls. Thomas E. Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his factual military reporting, and he joins us now. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
What made you decide to try fiction when you could really say anything you wanted to say about the military in factual reporting?
The primary thing I was trying to look at is why the U.S. military is so angry nowadays, so unhappy with its civilian leadership. And the second question I was trying to ask is this unique to the Clinton administration, or is it somehow structural? Is it going to be longer lasting? And my gut feeling was that it would be longer lasting, that yes, there were things unique to Clinton that did antagonize the military, but that really the reasons went far beyond that. For example, as late as the Vietnam War, two-thirds of the U.S. Congress had military experience. Today, two-thirds do not. And that is true as well for people at the White House, for people in business and financial elites, and as you and I both know, especially for the media. There's more stuff out there about World War II. I mean, Pearl Harbor, Saving Private Ryan, Ghost Soldiers, on and on. We go on endlessly about World War II. Yeah, we have a military out there that we pay almost no attention to.
I didn't cover the Pentagon all that long, but reading that novel, I began to think that I maybe recognized a real person here and there.
I think you probably did. I think of this as a reported novel. I actually went out and did interviews for this novel. Not only my regular interviews as a reporter for The Washington Post, but I would say, let's take off the Washington Post hat. This is for fiction. Your name's never going to appear. There are large sections of this novel that are quotations from people. There are emails I just slapped right into the manuscript off my screen asking questions. What were you thinking when you did this? What was your problem with the White House at this point? How did you deal with that?
I want to read, if I may, an inscription that you put at the front of your novel. You write, I have tried in this novel to render the English language as it is spoken in today's U.S. Army. To help the non-military reader, a glossary can be found at the end of the text. What does it say that if you try to realistically portray the way that military people speak and a civilian is reading it, they need a glossary to understand what's being said?
I think it underscores the fact that there is a real gap today between U.S. military and the society it protects.
Just so that people understand what we're talking about when we talk about a different language, I wonder if I could get you to read a paragraph here from your book, A Soldier's Duty, here on page 177.
You've picked a sentence that I purposely wrote to be the most opaque sentence in this book. Here, My lead character in my novel, which is a female intelligence officer named Cindy Sherman,
right. Is
thinking about two Army generals, the one she works for, an old kind of stick-in-the-mud infantryman named Shillingsworth, and a friend of his named General Still. She had watched Still interact with Shillingsworth. They were two old Army types, deeply sympathetic to each other in an inarticulate way. They seemed able to hold entire decision meetings in which they spoke only in a melange of acronyms, slang, tactical terms, and the nicknames of old friends. In her first week on the job, Cindy had witnessed them resolve a minor issue in which artillery doctrine was potentially at odds with mobility requirements. Still said, okay, I'll rub this down with the red leg side at TRADOC. You'll fire H&I to keep OSD PA&E off my back, and my XO will lash it up with Sly's schoolhouse at SIL. Shillingsworth had responded with muted hua. The catch-all Army response that in this case meant, I'm with you, next issue.
Could you define hua, please?
No, you cannot. It's an undefinable term that means anything from, I hear you absolutely and we'll move out smartly, to shut up and get lost.
Did it take you a while when you started covering the Pentagon to pick up on this language and learn it?
Yes, I've covered the Pentagon now for a decade, and it really strikes me that every day I am covering the U.S. military, I learn a new acronym. I ask people, what does that mean? The thing that surprises me frequently is how often they don't know what the actual acronym means. They're so used to using the acronym.
I was fascinated, though, reading the novel. One of the main characters that you just alluded to, General Shillingsworth, this old-time Army general, he's got this incredibly intricate language, but when it comes time to state his plain opinion about what needs to happen to civilian leaders, he gets so tangled up in his conceptions of duty and honor and what's right and what's appropriate and what's wrong that he can't say anything. He's completely inarticulate.
The Army, of all the services, is the least able to represent itself well in Washington. And I think for good reasons. The Army culture values the officer who stays quiet, moves out, executes his orders smartly. The problem with that is when they come to Washington to run the Army, everything that's taught them for the last 25 years about how to be a good Army officer does not serve them well in representing the Army in Washington.
You write a lot about the interaction of the media and Pentagon officials, top generals, and so forth. One of the most convincing passages, I think, in this novel is a scene in which General Shillingsworth goes into a room, basically says, if I can summarize, to these assembled generals, he thinks it's a private meeting, he's talking to his colleagues, and he says, you know, I really don't like this president, but I think we have to obey his orders. Somebody writes a memo of that, it gets leaked to a reporter for a paper that's quite obviously the Washington Post, and it completely gets turned around and becomes a front page headline. General thinks that the president is a, quote, jerk.
Yes. Well, we don't always get it right. And I think we should be the first to admit it, that sometimes we don't understand what goes on, that we do get things wrong. The media did not do a good job, for example, in covering Somalia. Somalia really bothered me. I covered the Marines briefly in Somalia in December 92, and it really struck me that the mission was not what was presented by the media. The media wanted to show happy children being fed and stories about, hey, there's real conflict out here, there are warlords, this is a society at war. We're hard to do for reporters, we're not welcomed by the gatekeepers, the people we file back to, either producers or editors or so on. And so I think that really got the U.S. public off on the wrong foot when they looked at Somalia. They thought it was a famine relief mission, peacekeeping, and it turned out to be we were in the middle of a small war out there. I think we did a little bit better in Haiti, and I think we did a lot better in Bosnia. I think the media, by and large, had a better take on what was happening in Bosnia than the U.S. military did.
Right now, you're covering a military that is responding to a new president and a new defense secretary who say that they would like to greatly reshape the military in some way. How do you think the military is responding to that?
I think the military is saying, sure, we had some problems with those Clinton fellas, but basically, we like the policies we developed for the post-Cold War underneath them, which was to go out and engage the world, to have a presence, to have boots on the ground in places like Bosnia and Kosovo, to have ships forward, to have a carrier battle group almost permanently in the Persian Gulf. They're very worried when they see this new administration come in and say, hey, let's not do those things. Let's cut back on some of those. So what they're saying is, hey, boss, you, fine, go ahead and transform the U.S. military. That's going to maybe cost $40, $50, $60 billion a year. Meantime, we think we're pretty busy out here, and we need about $330 billion a year, maybe $350. So what you got is a recipe for a $400 billion defense budget. The problem is, I don't think the White House is going to give it to them. And even if the president wanted to, the Congress won't. So you got a real train wreck forming up here.
Thomas E. Ricks is the military correspondent for The Washington Post, and he's the author of a novel called A Soldier's Duty. Tom, thanks very much, and hooah.
Hooah to you. Thanks.